This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene in Washington.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in New York. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner is about to go have a meeting with his bankers. Geithner travels next week to China, which is loaning billions of dollars to keep the U.S. government afloat. The U.S. and Chinese economies increasingly depend on each other, which does not necessarily mean that their governments are always getting along. Back in January, Geithner accused China of adding to the economic mess, manipulating its currency and undermining free trade. The Chinese quickly blamed Americans for the financial crisis. NPR's John Itzde looks at the competing claims.
Here's the short argument that China is partly to blame for the financial crisis. In its rush to industrialize, China ran up huge trade surpluses. It saved too much of the money it made selling its products. Then it lent too much of that money to America, says Peter Morici, an economics professor at the University of Maryland.
They accumulated dollars, and they invested those dollars in the New York bond market. That made it inexpensive for banks to loan us money through our homes on mortgages and second mortgages, and to loan us money on credit cards and to buy cars.
China flooded the U.S. financial markets with so much excess cash that it drove interest rates down, providing an irresistible temptation for Americans to take on more debt, says Morici.
It meant that the Federal Reserve couldn't pull in the mortgage frenzy when it wanted to. There was not much the Fed could do. It raised short-term rates, but long-term rates didn't go up with them. Mortgage rates didn't go up. And the terms got easier and easier, and people borrowed more and more.
Economist and China expert Nicholas Lardy agrees that Chinese money provided the fuel for the financial crisis.
The Chinese gave us the rope, but we didn't have to hang ourselves. If we had had tougher regulation, the inflow of capital from China would not have led to the crisis that emerged over the last year or so.
Lardy says the lack of regulation allowed U.S. investment firms to develop riskier financial products, and they did so with abandon as they tried to boost profits in the low interest rate environment created by the flood of cash from China. So why did China build up such large and destabilizing surpluses? Lardy and Morici disagree on China's motives. Morici thinks China made a deliberate decision to build its economy and its global power through exports.
Quite simply, China wants to have a very large trade surplus with the United States as a development tool to employ folks that are in the rural areas in the cities making things to sell here. So what it does is it keeps its currency very cheap.
But Lardy, a fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, thinks China sort of stumbled into the situation. Back in the 1990s, it decided to peg its currency to the dollar, a move that was viewed as positive back then. And for a while, it worked fine. The dollar appreciated, and so did China's currency, the yuan. That meant Chinese exports were more expensive, so despite its increasing productivity, China's trade surplus was manageable. But early in this decade, the dollar began to fall, and with its currency still pegged to the dollar, Chinese exports became cheaper. China sold mountains of goods, says Lardy, and its trade surplus soared.
Their goods became massively more competitive on international markets, and they developed large trade surpluses without any precedent in recorded history.
Lardy believes some Chinese leaders want a more balanced economy. But he says others with economic interests in export production have gotten addicted to the huge profits exports generate. They're resisting the calls from the U.S. government and others to allow the value of the yuan to rise. Secretary Geithner will raise the issue during his talks next week, but Lardy says that with China holding $1.5 trillion in U.S. Treasury bonds, the U.S. doesn't have a lot of leverage. Just last month, the Treasury blinked when it declined to officially call out China for manipulating its currency.
Certainly one of the reasons they probably didn't raise it to that threshold is, you know, the very common sense idea that maybe you shouldn't pick a fight with your banker. If you need to borrow a lot of money from somebody, you have to treat them perhaps with greater deference than you would if you didn't have that dependency.
Peter Morici argues it's the other way around. The fact that China has lent the U.S. so much money actually gives the U.S. leverage. That's because China needs a strong U.S. economy if it wants to be paid back in full. And, of course, it's still dependent on the U.S. consumer. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
President Obama plans to provide some answers of his own today about how to better protect the nation's computer networks. He'll be releasing a widely anticipated review of the nation's cybersecurity. Military and intelligence leaders say protecting computer networks from hackers, spies, and terrorists is one of the nation's top national security problems. And we have more this morning from NPR's Brian Naylor.
Foreign governments stealing U.S. military secrets, foreign companies stealing advanced technology and intellectual property from American firms. It happens every day, says James Lewis of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington think tank.
They're not mom-and-pop operations. They're not little kids. These are the spies of the 21st century, and they've been very successful.
Republican Congressman Michael McCaul of Texas, who contributed to a recent CSIS cybersecurity report, says the problem reaches across government. We reached him on his cell phone.
We know that last year alone, almost every federal agency had been penetrated, and massive amounts of data were stolen from our federal government.
The Pentagon, NASA, and air traffic networks were among those targeted. Lewis says the nation's power grid is particularly vulnerable. He points to a blackout 6 years ago that, while not caused by terrorists, was still disruptive.
You know, everyone remembers the 2003 blackout in the Northeast. It's likely that three or four countries have the capability to do that kind of thing again.
The president today is expected to lay out a strategy for protecting the nation's computer networks. It starts with a cybersecurity advisor who will report to him as part of the National Security Council within the White House. The president's economic advisors are also expected to have a role. Rod Beckstrom says the bureaucratic structure is important. Beckstrom recently resigned from his position as director of cybersecurity in the Department of Homeland Security. He's wary of giving the NSC and the military primacy over the civilian side.
The commercial sector is the primary user of the internet, and we as citizens, and the National Security Council doesn't in general represent that perspective as well as a group like the Council of Economic Advisers might, that are very attuned to the economy and business.
Privacy advocates, meanwhile, are worried that aggressive government efforts to secure the internet and other computer networks could trample privacy and civil liberties. Gregory Nogheim is with the Center for Democracy and Technology.
Unlimited government access to private communications would chill those communications.
Nogheim praises the Obama administration for listening to privacy concerns. Unlike many government problems, this one does not seem to require massive amounts of money. Instead, advocates say it's about better coordinating existing government efforts. Rod Beckstrom says one key component is making the internet more secure.
And that is the best investment we can make, and it's been almost entirely ignored by our federal government. And we might see something in this report to move a little bit in that direction. We need to go a lot farther.
And cybersecurity analysts say today's review cannot be the end, but only the start of the Obama administration's attention to the problem. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
In New York this weekend, the world's publishers are getting together for an annual book expo. The organizers say this year is about quality, not quantity. Large publishing houses will have one booth instead of three. Book sales are down. Publishers overall have been hit hard by the recession. But as NPR's Planet Money team discovered, there's a corner of the publishing world that has its own strange economy, poetry. Hannah Jaffe Walt explains.
If you're a poet, you send your work to hundreds of magazines, you get rejected, you send more, rejected, and repeat. Eventually, hopefully, you get some stuff published. Sometimes you can get a grant, not usually. You teach, you wait tables, whatever. Basically, no one is likely to pay you to write your poems. That's the poetry business, the po-biz.
The po-biz, yeah.
This is Keith Taylor. He teaches at the University of Michigan, and he's a poet, although he didn't make up that word. He's got a new book. Real bad time to have a new book out, right? Book sales are way down.
But I don't know. I just gave a reading last week, and, you know, much to my surprise, I sold, 15 copies. So that was a wonderfully pleasant surprise. I thought I might sell two.
Poets and their publishers, they've got their own economy going on, and it has very little to do with the one the rest of us live in. poets work and they don't expect to make money. The people who publish their books, small poetry presses, they don't either. People like Bob Hirshon with Hanging Loose Press in New York City. He says his friends in the commercial publishing industry, they're losing their jobs.
Well, we can't be out of work because we don't take any salaries.
You don't take any salaries?
No. Yeah, I don't know. We're nuts. But my co-editors and I just sort of work out of our hip pockets.
Small press editors like Bob Hirshon, he wants to get poems to the public. Poets like Keith Taylor, they want to get their poems to the public. So the press will front the money to print and bind the book, and then the poet, hopefully, recoups those costs by going out and doing readings and hitting up their friends to buy the book. Every friend they've ever had. Friends who, despite a recession, will probably still buy that book you wrote, that you didn't get paid to write and that the press didn't get paid to print. Here's Keith Taylor again.
It keeps the presence of poetry sort of removed from the hurly-burly of American economic life, which some people find effete and elitist. Some of the rest of us find it reassuring and a positive sign.
We thought we'd give you a chance to be an elitist poet or a reassured one. Take your pick. And we posted this call on our Planet Money blog, npr.org/money, for you to write your recession haikus. You remember haikus, 17 syllables, 5, 7, 5. And man, did you respond. So we're going to go out on those right now. I'm Hannah Jaffe-Walt, and here are your recession haikus read by friendly NPR people.
Collateralized debt. Oh, how I'm obligated. What tranche shall I be?
30 winters gone. Mills still empty by the shore. Some things won't return.
Put off surgery. It's not that noticeable. If you wear a hat.
Girl, you are so fine. I made you dinner myself. Ramen noodles.
I'm down to my last 17 syllables. There. Recession haiku.
And you can see a gallery of our favorite recession haiku on the Planet Money blog. Just check out npr.org.
Now let's talk about another industry that knows changes are ahead, the credit card industry. President Obama signed a measure last Friday that brought sweeping changes. In general, the new law limits or even bans certain credit card fees and interest rate hikes. It requires timely posting of payments and will give cardholders more information about their accounts in plain English. We have more this morning from NPR's Wendy Kaufman.
Banks and other credit card companies have known since last year that the balance of power between consumers and lenders was about to change. For example, consumers will get more advance notice of interest rate hikes, and raising those rates will be restricted in some cases. So what did some credit card companies do? Attorney Pamela Banks of Consumers Union says they raised rates while they still could.
We have seen them raise their interest rates on consumers in good standing, sometimes even doubling interest rates.
She has seen new fees being tacked on as well, and suggests that if you don't like what the credit card company is doing, tell them.
And oftentimes, if you question it, they will not charge you the fee or they will not increase your interest rate, but you have to be persistent.
While some companies have jacked up the cost of their credit cards, many others are already making the changes that will benefit consumers. Greg McBride, senior financial analyst for Bankrate.com, says consumers should be exploring what card is best for them. It won't be the same for everyone.
Ask yourself this question. Are you somebody who always, always, always pays the balance in full, or are you somebody who carries a balance, whether it's routinely or just occasionally? Because this is a real fork in the road in terms of how you shop for a credit card.
McBride says if you pay your bill in full every month, as 40% of Americans do, you're a perfect candidate for a rewards card, one that offers cash back, airline mileage, or other incentives. On the other hand, he says,
if you carry a balance, even occasionally, then your motivation needs to be getting the lowest interest rate you can and keeping your total costs of credit very low.
For example, McBride says, if you carry a high balance, your best bet may be a card that has the lowest interest rate, even if it has an annual fee. Websites such as Bankrate and another called BillShrink may be helpful in finding the best options for you. Another point. Because the new rules will make it harder to raise interest rates on existing cards, banks and credit unions may try to woo consumers who have a strong payment history. Peter Pham of BillShrink.com cautions that before signing up for that special introductory offer, read the fine print or contact the card issuer directly.
And ask them things such as, you know, when is it considered a late payment? What is my interest rate today? What is the interest rate if I make a late payment? What happens if I go over my credit limit?
Do I get charged a fee for that? And if so, how much? These are just a few of the many questions consumers should ask now and again next year after the new rules are in effect. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.